They say plants like music.
Yeah, no, like really, they respond to the vibrations of it, which means that this playlist you're listening to, the plants are too. You know what else plants like? Organic soil from Miracle-Gro. It's made with all the best stuff like wood fiber and compost. Plus, it's OMRI certified organic, which officially means it's made with superior ingredients. And when you give your plants the stuff that makes them happy, they won't judge you on your iffy playlist.
Hear that, plants?
So go ahead and give them Miracle-Gro.
Welcome to True Crime Garage. Wherever you are, whatever you are doing, thank you for listening. I'm your host, Nick, and with me, as always, is a man that would like to point out that if Hannibal Lecter could run a 4.340, he would have been drafted by the Oakland Raiders, and they would just say that he had an eating disorder. And that man is the captain.
And he'd probably complain about the fit of his helmet. It's good to be seen, and it's good to see you. Thanks for listening. Thanks for telling a friend.
This week we are drinking Cheer Team Ale by Three Floyds Brewing Company. This is big, bold, juicy, and fruity. A New England IPA. ABV 7.1% garage grade. 4.5 bottle caps out of 5. And this week's beer was brought to us by our very good friends joining us in the garage. We have Brianne in Yatahe, New Mexico.
And a big shout out to Carrie G in Parts Unknown.
Next up, we have Sadie and her awesome father listening in Branson, Missouri.
And a big what up to Sarah in Madison, Wisconsin.
Next, we have Danny in Springtown, Texas. And Captain, this is how far behind we are on the shout out line.
Right.
Danny wants us to cover the missing Fort Worth trio, which of course we did some point after he donated to the beer fund, of course. So thank you to Danny. That is a fascinating case. And he says that we would make excellent baseball commentators.
Cubs Wayne.
Looks like we're going to have a career after this gig is over, right, Captain?
Swing and a miss.
And last but certainly not least, here is a supercharged cheers to Anna in beautiful, beautiful Delaware, Ohio. Thank you to everybody for helping out with this week's beer fund. If you want to help fill up the fridge for next week's show, go to truecrimegarage.com and click on the donate button.
And for all of our old episodes, check our show out on the Stitcher app. And we have a weekly show called Off the Record. So if you need more Garage, go sign up. You can go to truecrimegarage.com and click on Off the Record. And that is enough of the business.
All right, everybody, gather around, grab a chair, grab a beer. Let's talk some true crime. We have 7 bodies in this investigation, a huge investigation going on, and a lot of media coverage. Now, law enforcement, they were worried that the discovery of the bodies and the media coverage that followed could invoke an evil reaction from our undetected serial killer, where he might go on a mass murdering spree, ultimately seeking more victims, more chaos and panic, and a suicide by cop ending.
And we have these extensive profiles, but really we don't have a ton of evidence. The biggest evidence that we probably have in this whole scenario is the bullets that they left behind from the target practice.
Yeah, the cuts and stab wounds are not extremely valuable from a clue standpoint. You know, we've discussed this before. It's just difficult matching these up to a knife or another sharp object when you have nothing to compare them to. Now, the bindings are of good value, though. Anything that was used to bind the victims, in some of these cases, we know that they used rope and electrical tape, that sort of thing. So, yes, Captain, you're exactly right. The most valuable clues that they're going to have are the bullets, the shell casings, the cartridge containers, as well as these ropes and electrical tape that was used on the victims.
Yeah, I would assume that it would be hard but not impossible to take these shell casings and figure out where possibly they bought these from or what rough location.
So in late 1993, the Task Force AIR was formed. They were to spearhead this serial killer investigation. The task force was made up of more than 20 detectives and analysts. On top of this, a large reward was offered to the public for information on what the press were calling at the time the Belanglo serial killings. The profiles were made, as we discussed, and they were made public. The task force was established, and now they're begging the public for help. So where does that get you? It gets you a ton of info to sift through, which is extremely difficult just to organize and catalog everything that's coming in. The task force, one of their first jobs is to simply organize all of this information and then to find a constructive way to apply it to the investigation. And as for the investigation, hell, just with 20 different task force members, you have a lot of moving pieces. And so some sort of checks and balances is required. You need to know for sure that so-and-so did speak to this suspect or this witness and that the information was collected and appropriately cataloged because there is just so much of it. Some of the focus is really going to be the gun angle, right, Captain? We know that we have bullets that were found at the scene. We know that we have two different calibers. We're looking through gun licenses. That's what police wanted to do. They're going to look through gun licenses to try to provide some leads in the way of who is their guy or who is their killers. I've seen some numbers in this case, and some were as big as that investigators may have been talking or seeking to talk to over 2,000 persons just in relation to the gun angle. But with all of their hard work, effort, and analysis, they really were looking at over 200 possible good suspects, not just people that have a gun license.
Right.
Eventually taking that 200 possible suspects and breaking that down to about 30. Some persons of interest without going through all 30 or so of them. Now, remember, guns may be how they're able to find the killer or killers. So they, amongst other strategies, are going around to gun clubs and interviewing members at these gun clubs. At one such club, they were interviewing members, and these members told investigators to talk to a man named Alex Malat. So Alex, he had a strange story to tell. He sat down and spoke with these investigators. He said that one night in April of 1992, now, mind you, this is around the disappearance of two of our victims.
Yeah.
He says that he and a friend were driving home that night from the gun club. And as they neared a service road to the Belanglo State Forest, they passed two vehicles. One, I believe, was a car and the other was a 4x4. In this scenario, he tells the investigators that he saw a woman, a single woman, in each one of those vehicles, right? And also in the vehicle with them were a group of men. The women, he says, were bound. They were, I take that back. I don't know that he said that they were bound. I know he said that they were gagged.
Mm-hmm.
But his description of this scenario is that the women, likely, they look to have been abducted. They're with these men. They don't want to be in the car. And he goes on to give very good, detailed information regarding the men and what they look like as well. He's unable to give any plate numbers regarding these vehicles. Police, of course, are going to find this extremely interesting for any number of reasons, really. What they're going to do is they locate the man that he says he was traveling with that night. They speak with him. The man verifies some portions of this story. Basically, that yes, I was with Alex that night. Yes, we went to the gun club. We took that route home. And I believe that, yeah, I did see two vehicles that night. He says nothing about the women being in the vehicles. He says nothing about the men being in the vehicles, nor does he give any type of description of yeah, anybody or anything that's going on.
Never mind that. If the gagging part didn't come up. Like, I mean, if you're driving home with your buddy and you see some girls, quote unquote, gagged, you'd think that would come up in conversation.
Right. And if it comes up in conversation, it's not something that you're going to forget. Especially right. if you can remember being at the gun club that day and taking that route home that night. So that's what is really a truly a weird scenario, because we have two victims that went missing right around that time. We have Alex Millette, who's saying that he saw two females in these vehicles that looked like they were abducted. Yet, here's the other thing, too. Until police came looking for him, he never bothered to share this information with anybody. He never took it to police. He never said, hey, I saw something strange going on, or, you know, he didn't do this when he didn't do it that night. So he didn't seem to be concerned of these two women. He didn't do it when the bodies were found. And as you just pointed out, he very likely didn't even mention it to the man sitting in the vehicle with him that night.
Right.
Because apparently, given their statements, they didn't see the same things.
Right. So it seems like it's a half-truth story.
Yeah, he may have, in fact, have seen two vehicles there that night, but is he making up what he saw inside of those vehicles?
That's a sick thing for somebody to make up.
Yeah, well, you have to wonder, one, why would he be making it up? Or two, if in fact that is what he saw, why didn't he tell anybody? Why did he choose not to tell anybody? Then there's another person police are talking about. This is one of their persons of interest. And this comes from a tipster that called in regarding a man named Richard Millette. Richard told a coworker, and this is according to the coworker, right? This is alleged what he told them. Richard said in regards to the backpack murders that there is a German couple out there, that they haven't found all of the bodies yet. This is before the German couple was in fact found. He tells someone else, I know who killed the German couple. Other odd things and comments that he was saying, he told someone how easy it would be to abduct someone out in the area of the Belanglo serial killings. He told someone that stabbing a woman or cutting a woman was just, and forgive me, Captain, I've seen this reported several different ways, that he said that it was like cutting a loaf of bread. And then one of the other sources say that he said cutting a woman was like cutting a banana. So I'm not sure which one he in fact used or allegedly said, but still some very odd, strange statements coming from this man here. I do want to point out a few things about what it is that alleged that he had said, right? The first, there is a German couple out there. They haven't found all of the bodies yet. This may seem strange given just that one statement that, and even in fact, when you apply it with all the others that we went through, but just that short little statement does seem strange. But we also need to keep in mind, as we reported, there were reports out there in June that there was a missing German couple. So that's not like it was some top secret information. That was public information to anybody that read those papers. Hey, there's a German couple that is believed to be missing since, regarding that newspaper article, it had been over 6 months by that point. And then on top of that, when they found the first two victims, when they found the first two bodies, what was the statement given by law enforcement at the time?
We're going to find more bodies.
We expect to find more bodies. So really, when you dissect his statement, it's actually nothing that anybody couldn't have come up with, right?
Right. And again, this is big news, and they don't want, you know, hitchhikers or tourists going missing. So is it just one of those things where you go, okay, they're going to find more bodies. Well, what about that missing couple that's still missing? I mean, it's not that far of a stretch to get to there.
The other thing, too, is pointing out how easy he believed it would be to abduct somebody out in that area, that specific area. I don't find that to be too incredibly of an odd statement.
Well, here's what's odd. We have two individuals with the same last name. Both seem what somewhat telling like half truths.
Right.
So what's that all about?
Well, I think the strangest statement by Richard would be the one of, I know who killed the German couple.
Yes.
The thing I would like to backtrack on, which I couldn't find through all the digging, it just wasn't there. If anybody finds this or knows this information, please put it on the blog. But one thing I was very curious about with the statement of, I know who killed the German couple, was he saying this before their bodies were found? Right?
Right, right, right.
Right? Because, I mean, of course, you could see how he would believe that they were killed, but to make a statement like that before the bodies were in fact found would be a big, huge red flag. And as you said, another red flag is that you have two individuals who share the same last name who, in fact, are brothers.
It goes back to that profiling, right?
Right. And that's the thing here. We're going to start to see some things regarding this profile. And I think that, you know, not only just the profile itself, but once they're collecting, the task force is collecting all this information that's coming in,
mm-hmm.
possible leads, possible evidence, clues, names that are coming up time and time again throughout the course of their investigation. You really want to go when we need to talk to 2,000 people or maybe more than 2,000 people, let's create a list of people and go, how many boxes does each individual potentially check off?
Right.
Because we have to prioritize who we're going to speak with. We can't just have a pool of suspects being 2,000 people. And then they whittle it down to, what did we say, 200 and then to 30?
Right.
But now on this list of 30, it appears that we have two men who are in fact brothers, and we do have them fitting some portions of the profile itself. You know, just the simple statement of somebody saying, you know what, it would be easy to abduct people out in that area. That to me does not set off any alarm bells as far as suspecting this person of being an abductor or a killer. What it points out to me immediately is this person obviously feels that he has a strong connection to that area, that he's familiar and he has knowledge about that area. Well, that's one thing that was in the profile to be looking for. We also have a situation where the other man, Richard Millette, he has a criminal record also in the profile. One of the things on his record involves a gun charge. Again, as you pointed out, back to the profile. Right. Now, there was also another Millette that is involved in this whole portion of the investigation. Ivan Millette. All three of them are brothers. They're brothers from a very large family. I think that there were 10 brothers total and 4 sisters.
Yeah, 14 siblings total.
Yeah, so we're talking a huge family here. Now, Ivan was, in fact, familiar to the task force. This is because he was called in on the tip hotline. Now, the caller thought that he fit some aspects of the profile. Plus, the caller said that he drove a 4-wheel drive and owns some guns.
Right. Known to shoot guns, has a 4-wheeler, also lives in a rural area.
Yeah. And I'll tell you what, even more interesting than all of that, this next stuff again comes from the Sydney Morning Herald. And the Herald really covered this story from top to bottom, covering it for years. There is an article by Stephen Warnock where we have a former senior constable, Paul Gordon. Now, anybody familiar with this case, there's some alarm bells that are going to go off because this Paul Gordon is a complicated character in this story, and we can get into that a little more. But what's important here is some things that we know that did in fact happen. We just don't know exactly how they happened because they were reported to the newspaper in a strange way, right?
Mm-hmm.
So according to one version of the story, Paul Gordon was working on a theory that Liverpool, I guess this is an exit that is along the way from Sydney to Melbourne via the Hume Highway. He or somebody else came up with the theory that there are hundreds of hitchhikers thumbing lifts south in this area, and that maybe this is where the killer or killers were getting their victims from. using this theory, they decide to go back and they are checking through police files for past crimes against hitchhikers in that area. What they find is a case from April of 1971, right? So almost two decades before our victims start disappearing.
Right, right.
In this case, the offender or alleged offender was a man named Ivan Millett. He was accused of assault, rape, and threatening to kill two female hitchhikers in April of 1971.
So we have the hitchhikers. We have a pair of them.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And we have a similar type crime, although it does not end in murder. But the reason why this crime does not end in murder, the two hitchhikers, they got away from this man.
Right.
And this is basically because they tricked him and they had to escape him. He didn't let them go. Nothing like that. They had to escape. And after reviewing the case, personally, Captain, I believe he very, very likely would have killed both of them. He, in fact, according to the two victims, did say at one point his intention was to do just that. Millett beat the charges, though.
Hmm.
And if you want, we can get into that. It's a bit of a difficult story, and it's a bit of a long one. But in the end, his lawyer pulled some tricky shit and got him out of those charges. Okay.
What do you mean, tricky shit?
Well, the lawyer was able to prove that the two women that he picked up were, in fact, lesbians.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. And the lawyer was... Here's the problem with that. It's 1971, 1972. When he points this out, this confuses the jury back then.
Right. And
you see what I mean?
And it's been an uphill battle for anybody that has come forward with any allegations of sexual assault or rape.
Right.
It's been an uphill
battle. Then,
so back then it was like
big time.
It's pathetic. But yeah, keep going.
Well, I do want to say this real quick too. The attorney that was representing Ivan Millett at the time, he is, I believe he's deceased now.
Mm-hmm.
He was a homosexual man.
Mm-hmm.
So in a sense, and I think, well, I shouldn't say I think, I know because interviews late in his life, he says that he really regretted using that tactic. But that's the tactic
that's
that he chose.
Job.
Yeah.
Right.
He chose to use that strategy.
Right.
It was shameful, but it worked at the time.
That is the problem with that profession, because it's like it's very important to have good defense attorneys, but at the same time and you don't want to assume that they're bad individuals because they help these awful people get out of crimes.
Well, Millett may have just been, and I mean Ivan, he's just super lucky, right? Because he was also facing charges, and these were hefty charges of armed robbery. In fact, these were robberies that he committed with one of his other brothers that we've already named. What ended up happening in that situation is those charges, I believe they were dropped because of the way that they were investigated. There was rumors of misconduct on the part of the police and the investigators in those crimes.
Mm-hmm.
And then we have this situation where Ivan Millett picks up these two female hitchhikers and comes pretty close to killing them
and gets away with it in court. Yeah, which is crazy to me because you have two eyewitnesses. You know what I mean? Like, it's not just he said, she said. It's he said, she said, she said. So, yeah, like you said, a little bit of evil luck.
But in the end, in the 90s, what's going to really stand out to the task force is that even though he may have got away with that crime back in the 70s, this very much fits. It's very similar to what was going on in the backpacker murders.
Well, right. Like, if we look at the profile, we have two victims. We have, you know, sexual intent, I think we could say.
I agree. Or some type of gratification from it.
Right. And then on top of that, you have these armed robberies that were committed with him and his brother and that fits the profile, you know, at least a couple times with them thinking that there could be two attackers and them being related.
So the Millett family, they are now pretty much the prime target of this investigation. And if you really want to try to put it in order, I think we're looking at a situation where we have Ivan at the very top of that list, followed by his brother Richard.
Mm-hmm. And Ivan just looks like, I mean, he looks evil.
Well, and the other thing that's going to put Ivan and Richard above some of the other brothers in this, even Alex, who we've already named, those two were known to have been working in the area at the time of the disappearances.
Mm-hmm.
So that puts them at a much higher probability. So they were looking into these men from this family. And the more that they looked, the more that Ivan started to look better and better and fit being their possible unsub. So this becomes even more clear when police get a phone call from the United Kingdom. It's Paul Onions. On November 13th, 1993, Paul called the authorities in the backpacker murders case. He saw the case on the news and he immediately thought of the time when he was attacked way back in 1990. Police never made the connection between Paul's case and the seven unsolved murders. Remember, when Paul reported this, from the outside looking in, you may have thought you were just dealing with an armed robbery. So now we have a victim coming forward and saying, I believe what happened to me is connected to your unsolved murders. Eventually, they get Paul out to Australia, and they want to talk with him face to face. They want to show him some materials, and they want to know what he knows of his attack. Eventually, he positively identifies Ivan Millett as the man who was calling himself Bill, who offered him a ride and tried to take his life, firing the gun at him as he was running from him. Joanne Barry, the woman who was brave enough to stop her van and allow a complete stranger to get inside the vehicle when others wouldn't even stop to help poor Paul, she was able to positively identify Ivan Millett as the man that she said she saw that day with the gun. It was almost the perfect crime. Everyone was distracted, their attention elsewhere. Stacks of cold, hard cash sitting on the table unguarded. Who wouldn't be tempted to slowly reach their hand out and steal a pile of Monopoly money from the banker? Monopoly is one of those games that can bring out everyone's most devious selves. And Monopoly Go takes that gleeful mischievousness to your phone in a wildly popular twist on the classic game that you can play throughout your day, anywhere, anytime. Collect rent from friends on iconic properties. Bankrupt them by pulling a heist on their vault. And Monopoly Go has timed tournaments where you can team up with friends to unlock big prizes and try to top the leaderboards. Whether you're helping out your friends or going head-to-head for riches, Monopoly Go is an absolute blast. Download it now free on the App Store or Google Play.
Do you want to set your child up for success? Of course you do. That's why you need to check out IXL Learning today. IXL Learning is an online learning program for kids covering math, language arts, science, and social studies. IXL is designed to help them really understand and master topics in a fun way. It's powered by advanced algorithms. IXL gives the right help to each kid, no matter the age or personality. There's one site for all kids in your home, pre-K to 12th grade. Kids could use it at home on their computer or on an app on your phone or a tablet. No more grading those worksheets. IXL grades everything for you. 1 in 4 students in the U.S. are learning with IXL. IXL is used in 95 of the top 100 school districts in the U.S. I love recommending IXL Learning. Kids can learn at home or on the go. And all my friends and family that are using it absolutely love it because it's so easy to set up and so easy to use. And even the kids that I've recommended it to their parents have told me, hey, Captain, thank you. I was having problems in math and my parents couldn't help me, but IXL could. Do you want to get your kids back on track or do you just want to get your kids ahead? Do so with IXL Learning. Make an impact on your child's learning. Get IXL now. And True Crime Garage listeners get an exclusive 20% off IXL membership when you sign up today at IXL.com/garage. Visit IXL.com/garage to get the most effective learning program out there at the best price. Check out IXL.com/garage today.
Have you ever thought about why your wireless bill is so damn expensive? It's all just radio waves. And how much can radio waves really cost? It seems like Big Wireless all got together and decided $100 a month. Now, thanks to Mint Mobile, you have a choice. For a limited time, all phone plans from Mint Mobile are $15 a month when you purchase a 3-month plan. Say bye-bye to your overpriced wireless plan's jaw-dropping monthly bills and unexpected overages. All plans come with unlimited talk and text, plus high-speed data delivered on the nation's largest 5G network. So ditch overpriced wireless with Mint Mobile's limited-time deal and get premium wireless for just $15 a month. I love Mint Mobile. They have great quality. They have wonderful service. I love saving money. Put them together, and I'm getting great quality, great service, a wonderful phone plan for only $15 a month. To get this new customer offer and your new 3-month unlimited wireless plan for just $15 a month, go to mintmobile.com/TCG. That's mintmobile.com/TCG. Cut your wireless bill to $15 a month at mintmobile.com/TCG. $45 upfront payment required, equivalent to $15 a month. New customers on first 3-month plan only. Speeds slower above 40 gigabytes on unlimited plan. Additional taxes, fees, and restrictions apply. See Mint Mobile for details. Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never frozen meal is chef crafted, dietitian approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options and more than 60 add-ons every week. What are you waiting for? Get started today and fuel up for your springtime goals. Factor's ready to eat meals are on the table in 2 minutes. Eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning up. Simply heat and savor the good stuff. Customize your weekly meals with as much or as little as you need. Pause or reschedule deliveries to suit your lifestyle. Factor is your solution for fast premium meals without the need for cooking. They're celebrating Earth Day all month long. Look out for the Earth Day Eats badge on the menu for their lowest carbon footprint meals. I am always on the go. I'm rather busy. And grabbing a quick meal, for me, used to mean eating the bad stuff. But I've switched to Factor. Now I simply grab a Factor meal from my refrigerator, heat, and then I am enjoying a delicious meal in just 2 minutes. And it's not loaded with the bad stuff. Head to factormeals.com/truecrimegarage50 and use code truecrimegarage50. To get 50% off your first month, plus 20% off your next month, that's code TRUECRIMEGARAGE50 at factormeals.com/TRUECRIMEGARAGE50. 50% off your first box, plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
All right. Cheers, mates.
Cheers, 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 Captain. Law enforcement, they were locking in on this Ivan Milet. Mm-hmm. They surveilled Ivan for weeks. They tapped his phone, and police located a vehicle that he once owned. This is the four-wheel drive vehicle that Paul Onions says that this man named Bill, quote-unquote mm-hmm. Bill, was driving when he picked him up and attacked him. So they found this new owner. They confirmed that it was, in fact, a vehicle that was purchased from Ivan. Still inside the vehicle, they located a .22 caliber bullet under the driver's seat. It matched bullets that were found at the murder scenes.
Got him.
So this is some big info here. There's some difficulty with the investigation because of another brother, and this brother's name is, in fact, Bill.
Right.
So what becomes difficult with this case is Ivan, for whatever reason, was registering vehicles in his brother's name for a good portion of his life.
Mm.
The other thing, too.
Why is he doing that?
I don't know if this was with his brother's permission or if he was just doing this on his own.
Right.
But surely if you are up to no good, it is an advantage for you to be able to drive vehicles but not have them necessarily in your name, right?
Mm-hmm.
So with all this information and a lot of it being information coming from Paul Onions, it sounds like police are ready to make an arrest, and they're going to arrest Ivan Milet. But remember, all along, they anticipated that their killer, should they be on to the right guy, if the heat got cranked up too high for his liking, if an arrest was expected, he very likely would want to do it on his own terms and go out in a blaze of glory.
Yeah.
Police knew how dangerous whoever this man was. They knew that who they were looking for is probably a weapons enthusiast. So they knew.
Psycho, though.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah.
This is a psycho.
So they knew what to expect if they, in fact, had their right guy. So when they go to make the arrest on Ivan Milet, they're going to be a little nervous in this situation, but they're also going to bring everything that you got, right? You bring the kitchen sink. Ivan's house was surrounded by about 50 armed officers, most of them heavily armed officers. Phone calls were placed to the home. The general strategy here is, Captain, you want to try to get your guy to come outside. You really want to avoid going in after him. So on these phone calls, they're trying to explain to him why they want to talk to him, why he is being arrested that day. And a good strategy here, for many reasons, they basically tell him, look, you're suspected in an armed robbery. We need to talk to you about that. And we have a warrant for your arrest in regards to that case. Notice that they are conveniently avoiding the 7 unsolved murders when talking to Ivan.
Right.
Ivan didn't want to come outside. He did this kind of weird game of like cat and mouse, where at first he kind of said, yeah, I'll be out. Just give me a few minutes. And then a lot of time would go by and he still had not come out. This, of course, making the police more nervous as it goes along. They would call him back. He would try the same tactic. I'm coming out, but I don't understand why you're here to talk to me. I've not done anything wrong. Now he's playing the innocence card.
Right.
This goes back and forth for a while until he does eventually end up coming outside.
Right. So on May 22nd, 1994, Ivan Milet is arrested.
Correct. And we talked about the former constable earlier who gave the story to Steve Warnock and a story to the Sydney Morning Herald.
Mm-hmm.
This is Constable Paul Gordon. This is where Paul Gordon's story gets tricky. And I've tried to sift through this, and I can't really find out the real details here. But what we do know is that Paul Gordon at some point spoke to the newspaper, okay? And in this time that he's talking to him initially, it seems like he not only takes credit for the theory brought forward about the hitchhikers and the location, but he also takes credit for finding the previous case from 1971 that names Ivan Milet as the suspect. And he tells this to the newspaper. So mm-hmm. He presents a story in the light where it's almost like I'm the guy that cracked the case. And in a lot of tellings of this story in this case, it seems more so that maybe just as much as that scenario, but it also seems like the Paul Onions, the former victim, the survivor that came forward, was just as much that cracked this case.
Right.
And so where Paul Gordon gets in trouble, the former constable, where he gets in trouble, there was an agreement amongst the task force and amongst the members that were the closest involved in this investigation and in the arrest of Ivan Milette, that they were not to talk to the newspapers. Paul Gordon did. So Paul Gordon was eventually let go from that task force. That's why it gets difficult to sift through his words and know what to believe and know not what to believe.
Right, right.
Because we don't know if he was let go because he talked to the paper or if he lied being the guy that, quote unquote, cracked the case. But that was something that went down. Now, because Paul Gordon spoke to the newspapers, now a lot of their stuff is starting to become public. That's why they didn't want anybody talking to the newspapers that were involved in the task force.
That makes it harder to get a conviction.
Yeah, and it also makes it tougher for the investigators to continue down the roads that they've already traveled down. They've already started down these roads on investigating Ivan Milette for 7 unsolved murders. They've only arrested him for the armed robbery charge. Now it shows their hand that this is what we actually want him for. This is what we actually think he's suspected of.
Right, and the fact that they're still not for sure if it's just Ivan that's responsible or is it Ivan and one of his brothers that they've already talked to. And so you don't want to show all your hand because you don't want Ivan to be protecting one of his brothers and then you have another psychopath that's out on the loose.
Well, and you want to make sure that you have your right guy and you want to make sure that you are building your case as such. But now with their cards kind of shown, with their cards out there, this is when the lead member of the task force says, we were kind of forced at this point to actually start charging him with these unsolved murders. Now, at the same time, the whole thing that's really going down, and actually they've been working their way through this, there were searches, obviously, of Ivan's home and of many of his family members' homes as well. And they were very smart. They did these searches basically all at the same time. So as you pointed out, we can't have the different Milette family members warning each other of what's going on if, in fact, more are involved.
Yeah, so now that they have Ivan in their sights, they're going to have to search their property. They live just outside the city.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and as said, they're going to search some of his family members' homes about the same time, right? Well, they find some interesting things in Ivan's home. Most importantly, they find a .22 rifle.
Mm-hmm.
They find parts to another .22 rifle. They find a pistol, and they find one of those large Bowie knives. Now, he has said time and time again to the investigators that he didn't own any weapons. And, of course, they immediately find weapons inside his home. They also recovered a trove of items believed to belong to the killed hitchhikers. These items included clothing, tents, sleeping bags, backpacks, cooking and camping equipment, and cameras. This is a lot of stuff. And some of this stuff, they can't 100% say belong to a victim.
Right.
But they can say, I believe it was with one of the, it was with some of the camping equipment.
Yeah, they found it, like, was a tent. And
yeah, no, but what I mean by this is there was one of these items, you couldn't purchase it in Australia.
Right.
You had to purchase it from where one of the victims was from. So the probability that he would own something like this, highly unlikely.
Right.
And then on top of that, we have scenarios where there are items that do seem to, in fact, belong to the victims, where you can make a direct connection, where there's more proof of such, like the initials being stitched into one of the items.
Right.
And so this is not looking good for Ivan. So they searched his mother's home as well, and at least 3 of his brothers' Holmes as well. So this would be Alex, Richard, and Bill.
I believe his father was dead.
His father had passed away. Wait, no, they would have searched at least four of the brothers because Walter, his home was searched as well.
Mm-hmm.
His sister, Ivan's sister, is a bit tricky for me because, look, so that not only is this a big family with a lot of brothers and a lot of moving pieces, but at one time, throughout their adult lives, they were all, a lot of them were moving back and forth in and out of mom's home.
Mm-hmm.
And so some of them lived together for a while under her roof. And I believe that maybe even Ivan and his sister shared a home together at one time. What the big problem is with this is that not only do they find these damning items inside Ivan's home, they start finding other items that belong to these victims in the homes of his relatives as well. And again, this is things like clothing, tents, backpacks, cookware, things of that nature. Now, some of these brothers' homes, they found guns, lots of ammo, and marijuana. So at the very least, those brothers can be arrested and charged with, if they had illegal guns. We know that the drugs were illegal. There were charges that were brought forth on that nature. Now,
well, yeah, this family was known to, one, own a bunch of guns, but to be avid shooters. You know, they're, like I said, they lived out of the city, and this is a time where you don't have internet and cable and things like this, so they were avid, you know, gun shooters.
Well, and a lot of the brothers had, they were rowdy, let's say, right? A lot of them had criminal records.
Well, there's 10 of them. I mean, if you grow up in a family just with one other sibling, you're going to tend to get in some arguments or fights or, you know, little tussles, especially if it's, you know, two boys, because you got all those.
Or commit armed robbery together like they did.
Yeah, but what I'm saying is there's 10 of them, so you just got this testosterone going, and, you know, it wasn't rumored. I think it's pretty factual that these kids were beat, at least the boys were beat up pretty bad by their father consistently. Very abusive household. So when you have that going, and that probably stems from anger and stems from a lack of resources and a lack of money, and also you have 14 kids that you're trying to feed. You want to talk about stresses. You know, when you get beat by your father, you might then try to take that out on your brother.
Well, regardless of all these items that they find throughout the different households, when this thing comes to trial, Ivan's going to be the only one facing trial. And he's now being charged with the 7 murders, as well as the crimes against Paul Onyons. Ivan, to his credit, during the whole time that he's being investigated, during the whole time of his interrogations and the questioning and the interviewing,
right,
and even the trial itself, he's always stuck to his guns. He has, regardless of what he's been accused of, he's maintained his innocence throughout. Now, at trial, not only did he maintain his innocence, he, in fact, pointed the finger at a couple of his brothers. This would be Walter and Richard. And his defense that was put forward basically was stating that the crimes were not committed by Ivan. They were either committed by one or both, Richard and Walter.
Right.
The interesting thing here, too, though, is the Crown. Okay, so basically the prosecutors and whatnot. They are saying during the course of this trial, we do not have to prove whether Ivan acted alone or not.
Right.
We just are trying to prove that he was involved, that he did it. And they said that the evidence, they actually pointed this out, which is weird to me, but at one point, they even said something to the fact that the evidence somewhat strongly suggested that he may not have acted alone. But they were so sure that he was, in fact, involved. He is, regardless of who else could have been involved, Ivan was responsible for the crimes we are charging him with.
And this time, they're going to get a guilty verdict.
Yeah, I mean, it was a difficult trial for all the reasons that we just pointed out, but it was, in fact, July 27th, 1996, a jury found Ivan Milet guilty of 7 unsolved backpacker murders. Mm-hmm. He received 7 life sentences for this without the possibility of parole. But our story doesn't end there, does it, Captain? We got some more stuff to get through. Mm-hmm. Because on his first day to the Maitland jail where he was going to be housed, Ivan was beat up by another inmate. So there is your housewarming gift for you, Mr. Ivan. Welcome to prison.
Yeah.
You get your ass kicked on day one.
You get fucked up.
A year later, Ivan and another inmate, George Sava, they worked together in an attempt to escape from prison. However, they were caught in this attempted escape plan, and the next day, they find George dead in his cell. Now, they move Ivan to another prison, to a maximum security prison at another location. There are some more prison antics here. Ivan swallowed razor blades and staples in a metal chain on one day.
He swallowed some razor blades.
Yeah. And then in 2009, he cut off his little finger with a plastic knife.
On purpose?
Yeah. Yeah, so this is a just kind of a real dumbass plan here. But so he gets this is actually considered a privilege at the prison where he was housed.
Mm-hmm.
If you were under good behavior for X amount of period, at some point you are allowed to receive a plastic knife, like what you would get at a picnic.
Right.
A plastic knife to use while eating your meals. He had received this privilege, and once he did so, he decides to take a plastic knife and attempts to cut off his little finger, to which he was successful, but his goal was to put the finger in the mail, put it in an envelope, hand it off to a guard, and ask them to mail it. Well, as the newspaper put it, cutting off a finger is quite painful. So once he got to that part of the plan, where the finger is now off, he had trouble putting it in the envelope and getting it to the guard. Basically, his plan went sideways real quick because he didn't account for how much pain he would be in. He was transferred to a hospital because of this, but they could not reattach the finger. So it is no more. He has on several occasions attempted hunger strikes to get things that he wants to get his way.
Mm-hmm.
The most famous of these hunger strikes lasted 9 days. This was because he wanted a PlayStation in his cell. The hunger strike ended, and I'm very happy to report that little Ivan did not get his PlayStation.
Oh, so sad.
One key thing with this case has always been, are there more victims?
Yeah.
And if there are, how many more?
Well, are there more victims? I mean, because like you said, he had the crimes a decade earlier that he got acquitted for.
Mm-hmm.
So that just makes you wonder how many missing people are there and how many missing people have not been reported missing because they were foreigners.
Well, and we're also talking about from the time that he abducted those two women, beat the charges, and then to the time that he's finally arrested, we have 2 decades that went by.
Right.
2 decades that went by, and the murders that he's convicted of, they actually happened in just the years leading up to his capture.
Right.
So how long was he active for? And if, in fact, he was going to kill those victims back in 1971, was that his intention all along if he was active that entire time? I mean, we know he shot at Paul Onions, so it appears that murder was his intent there, mm-hmm. or at the very least was his reaction to Paul trying to flee him. Now, we know that Ivan was questioned back in 2004, this regarding the disappearance of 2 nurses back in 1980. He was working in the area at the time. Then 2 years later, in 2006, Ivan was named by police as the main suspect in a double homicide. In all, it looks like there may have been about 10 more cases that they like him for it. They think that he's a good suspect in these 10 other cases.
Right.
And one of these cases dates all the way back to 1971.
But we don't think he's going to confess to these.
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, he's never been one to confess. He's always maintained his innocence throughout, even all this time in prison.
Mm-hmm. Possible deathbed confession.
Yeah, and the thing here, though, too, is I really wonder about a lot of these other cases, because it would point out to me a couple of things. Either he wasn't taking trophies from the earlier victims,
mm-hmm.
or he discarded of those trophies at some point. It's just very difficult, because I think he's probably good for some more. I don't think he's good for all 10 or 12 of these, depending on what list you look at.
Well, we both agree that he's responsible for the attacks on the lesbian couple.
Oh, yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
So we agree on that.
Yeah, I'm actually really shocked that even whatever, you know, regardless of the strategy, I'm shocked that any strategy worked in that case after reviewing it.
But I think you said it best, though. I think it was because it was so, you know, so many years ago.
Mm-hmm.
That's why that malarkey worked. But that being, you know, almost caught for that, and then the armed robbery, that could have been enough to possibly scare this psycho away for a while.
Mm-hmm.
So like you said, do you like him for all these crimes? I don't know. I think he would have been taking more items from the victims, like you were saying.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I wonder in some of these cases. I've seen with two of them that I've reviewed out of that list, those two almost feel to me like there is no real connection. And look, I get it. There is no real connection between Ivan and the ones that he is convicted of. But in the others, there seems to be more of a scenario where he looks good for those. There is some connection. He was in the area at the time. He may have been active at the time, so on and so forth.
Right.
A couple of them, you wonder if they're just starting, hey, well, let's take a shot at it. It's like throwing a dart at the board and hoping that you close a case off of little to nothing.
Right.
So in 2012, his nephew, Matthew Millett, was convicted in court of murder, because in 2010, he attacked a boy named David Arcelloni.
Mm-hmm.
So this poor kid, David, was struck over the head with a battle axe. It was a double-bladed battle axe. And get this. This attack took place in the Belanglo State Forest, the same place where Ivan Millett buried seven victims in the 90s. So David was, I don't know if you would call him a friend, but they knew each other. Matthew and David knew each other. And another guy, Cohen Klein, was friends with Matthew Millett as well. The two 19-year-olds, Matthew and Cohen, they lured 17-year-old David. This was on his birthday, to the state forest. They got him to go along with them because they were promising him, hey, it's your birthday. We're going to party at the state forest. We got booze. We got pot.
Mm-hmm.
Really, the whole thing was a setup, because once they get there, at some point, Matthew starts chasing David around a car with the axe. Now, the super gross and disgusting thing in this case is the Cohen Klein, the other person there, Matthew's friend.
Right.
As Matthew is attacking David, Cohen, he recorded the whole thing on the audio anyway, on his mobile phone. And both of these guys were convicted. Millett got 43 years, and then we have Klein got 30 years. I'm sorry, might have been 32. My notes are a little difficult here. But in the Klein case, he has a minimum sentence of 22 years that he's going to face for that.
Mm-hmm.
And the saddest part of it is this murder took about 2 minutes to commit. The audio recording, it recorded the full 2 minutes. And the judges heard it, and some of the people at trial heard portions of this audio, and it was very clear that this young man, this boy, David, was he was basically tortured and suffered very badly the last 2 minutes of his life. The strangest thing about this Matthew Millette character, the nephew who's now in prison, and I don't know if there's a way to change this or the exact stipulations of his sentencing. This Matthew Millette guy should never be allowed out of prison.
Yeah,
it's the absolute worst.
I really think, and I don't want to get into this too much, but I think, you know, cost effectiveness and all this stuff with the death penalty, it doesn't work for some states, but it should be this simple. You kill somebody, first degree murder, you go away for life.
Yeah. Let's not get, this is a long road to go down.
Right.
With,
but you know what I mean?
Not like a lot of time.
He tortured this guy. We have,
and we know he did
evidence of it. And he's going to possibly get out one day. And all he's going to do is chances are, now what we can hope for is that he will not be a model citizen in prison, and then he'll have to do more time. But yeah, these individuals, they can't be helped.
Well, as Justice Matthews pointed out during the trial during the sentencing phase anyway, was that Millette showed no remorse and poses a huge, serious threat to the community. This basically was a cold-blooded, premeditated thrill kill that this guy did. And then on top of that, what's weird too is that is not his last name by birth. Yes, he's related to Ivan Millette, but he's like a great nephew of him. And he had a different last name, but changed it
to
Millette when he was 14. Right. Now, I don't know if he was just going by the last name of Millette rather than officially having changed it. But regardless, I mean,
right. You're a psycho.
You see where we're going with that. Yeah. Now, we talked about the case against Neville Knight in the trailer, and I'm betting some of you are wondering, what does that have to do with this case? We never really gave you the outcome of the story of the 16-year-old boy who was picked up by the cab driver. The explosion that the cab driver heard, the boy fired a gun through the back seat, shooting Neville in the back. Okay. And the boy, rather than helping Neville, he just opened up the door, observed the damage. He wanted to see the damage done. And he ran off into the darkness.
Mm-hmm.
We do have a man that was convicted of that crime. This was a guy that confessed shortly after. This was a few months after the fact. We have Alan Dillon, who confessed to shooting Neville Knight in the back in that cab. He was sentenced to 5 years for the shooting. The attack left Neville Knight a paraplegic, and he didn't live an extremely long life. He did live many years after that, and he did a lot of good for other people. He became an advocate for wounded individuals. So he did a lot of good in his life, but where this story kind of circles back around is in 2015, Ivan's brother, Boris Millette, he said that Ivan told him he was the one that shot Neville Knight back in 1962 in that cab, that he shot the cab driver, observed him, and ran off. Now, where we get the confession from is many years later, Alan Dillon, the man who served 5 years for this attack, he said the way it was presented to him during the interviews with police was that they suspected his younger brother, Alan Dillon's younger brother, of committing the crime. Alan Dillon took it upon himself to give them a false confession to spare his brother the jail sentence.
Right.
And unfortunately, all these years later, when this story finally comes to light in 2015, Neville Knight is no longer around to confirm these suspicions. But if, in fact, Boris's statements regarding his brother saying, I was the one that shot that cab driver in 1962, you can see the progression And it also goes to what you can imagine Ivan was doing to his victims out there in the state forest as he traveled, as he chased them down. Remember, choice of weapon killer, choice of victim killer. Mm-hmm. He got them out there. He chose his weapons. He chose his attack. And it's almost, you see the progression that started at the age of 16 when he sat in the back of that cab and fired the gun into the seat and into the back of Neville Knight. We do have a somewhat of an update. I know it's our first time covering this, but Ivan has been in the news quite a bit lately. And this is because in May of this year, May of 2019, Ivan Milet was, it's been reported anyway, that he was diagnosed with terminal esophageal cancer. Mm-hmm. And I know I probably didn't say that in the best way, but it's basically cancer of the esophagus. This, from my understanding, a friend of mine, his father suffered this same type of cancer. And from what I've been told, this is not a, look, they're all bad cancers, but this one is particularly bad where the survival rate is not very high at all.
Mm-hmm.
So as you pointed out earlier, Captain, you wonder, given that this man probably has days left, if in fact we will see some type of deathbed confession, maybe it's not all the information that's out there. Maybe it doesn't, you know, but maybe it clears some things up. We have other family members of his that have been accused by the public and suspicions upon them throughout the years. Ivan did say through when he was in prison, many years after he was convicted, that his brothers are not guilty of anything, although he still claims to be innocent of the murders himself.
Right, but I want to break down that scenario a little bit better, because I think him trying to put the blame on his brothers, I think that eventually came back to his mother, and he was kind of favored by his mother. Ivan was, so eventually at some point, the rumor is, or what people speculate is, that he told his mother, hey, they're not responsible, and actually confessed to her all of his crimes. That's what they believe.
Yeah. Yeah. I went down that road and I,
but it's not like she has wrote him down and, did a press conference about it or anything.
So the way that I understand that is that one of the lead investigators, I believe he was the man in charge of the task force. He wrote a book, and his name escapes me at the moment, but he wrote a book about the case. And actually there are several books out there regarding this case.
Yes.
The way that I understand the story is that investigator eventually heard this statement through one of the brothers, that the mother apparently told one of the brothers, Ivan confessed to me, and then she passed away. So like everything else with this story, it's not a clean ending. It's okay. This story comes from one of the other brothers. We know that other brothers were,
well, and the other claim,
suspects, right, or you know, at least suspicion from the public.
Yeah, because some of the items that they found that they believe Ivan had were actually found in his brother's possession.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But now if you follow that story back, it was items that he took from his family's home when he moved. So it wasn't like, these items just happened to be at his house. These items came from the family's house. But I think what's also really interesting is his defense lawyer which defended him, you know, decades earlier in the trial of the
Marsden, I think was his last name.
And before he passed away, he was saying that he believed that none of the brothers actually helped Ivan, but it was actually Ivan's sister that helped him commit these crimes.
Yeah, I saw that. The other thing that's weird here, though, while we talk about the brothers, Walter Millett. So one of the most damning pieces of evidence against Ivan during the course of his trial, remember we stated that there were some firearms found in Ivan's home, but actually the thing that was worse for him was the piece. I said there were some gun parts that were found in his home.
Mm-hmm.
It was one of the parts of a .22 rifle that was found. That was a piece of evidence that was so very strong against Ivan because it was found concealed in his home, like hidden, like purposely. If you saw the thing, you knew like somebody was trying to hide this and not just hide it for today, tomorrow, or next week. They didn't want anybody to find it ever.
Mm-hmm.
So when they found this piece and they ran their ballistics on it, of course they had to, you know, reattach it to other pieces of guns and things like that. But what they determined after firing bullets through that part was that the markings on those bullets matched markings on bullets at multiple crime scenes, at multiple murder scenes. Basically knowing that that part of that gun was involved in the murder of those victims. That was found in Ivan's home, in his possession. What's interesting is out of all these brothers, we say he's got four sisters and nine brothers, big family. Out of the whole family, Ivan had a fairly sophisticated security system. And he was known to be extremely protective and secure of his home. And we can only imagine the many reasons why.
Mm-hmm.
Out of all of his family, Walter Millette was the only one that had access 24/7 to his home. So many have wondered throughout the years, this piece of evidence that was really the strongest piece of evidence against Ivan, Walter would have had the ability to place it in the home.
Yeah, there's a lot of stuff with this family, and we could probably spend another hour talking about some of the speculation, but just to go over it really quickly, at some point people believe that Ivan was having affairs with his brother's wives. There's also then rumors that Ivan was having a sexual relationship with one of his sisters. Supposedly the whole family knew about it. Supposedly multiple brothers had sexual relationships with that sister. You know, like I said, there was reports of physical abuse from the father, possible physical abuse from the mother. And so then you wonder if he was having an affair with one of his brother's wives, is that enough to, you know, plant evidence, you know, to get him convicted of a crime he didn't commit? There's just so many things strange about this family and so many things you could dive in, the speculation of this family.
Well, Ivan Millette is often referred to as Australia's most notorious and infamous serial killer. And even though we have the convictions, we are left here today believing we still do not have all the answers. And how about a little recommended reading before we wrap things up for this week? This week, we're going to recommend BTK, the true story behind the 30-year hunt for the notorious Wichita serial killer by the great John Douglas. This, of course, this recommendation in the spirit of Mindhunter Season 2, which we have been discussing and will be discussing on our other great show, Off the Record. So until next week, everybody out there, be good, be kind, and don't litter.
Here you are, BPMs high, sweat dripping, body moving, tongue panting. You're working hard, real hard, and you're thirsty. You need vitamins, nutrients for peak performance and energy.
And your plants do too. Aw, I mean, just look at the little guy. Water-soluble plant food from Miracle-Gro is full of essential nutrients. Just a little scoop into your watering can and boom, instant feeding and bigger, more beautiful plants. It's kind of like a sports drink for your plants. You may have to suffer from heat, but your plants do not.